Welcome to this episode of Pivotal Change. I'm your host, William Kahn, and we have a very exciting episode for you tonight. We're going to be talking on a global scale about influence and leadership, and I hope you have your pen and paper ready because we're going to get into the analysis of how high-stakes systems can mesh with cultural movements, global industries, specifically things like the media and how to keep up with stuff like, let's say, you know, FIFA and international sports. So we are actually witnessing kind of a structural evolution across the global market as this comes up, and the World Cup is the exact thing that is going to allow people to either scale or fall behind. So we're going to analyze kind of what this brilliant logistical blueprint might look like. And we've brought an expert, somebody that has great influence in areas of media today, Gonzalo Lira. He's a prominent entertainment journalist. He's a film critic. He's Golden Globes international voter, and he's also a dynamic host of one of our very own Now Media TV shows, The M Flow. So, Gonzalo, welcome to Pivotal Change.
Hi, William. Thank you so much for the invite. I'm so excited to talk with you about this.
Well, good. I want to kind of discuss with you maybe a three country experiment as this World Cup is unfolding. And what we have is we have this global event. It's coming across all these separate nations and, of course, bring people from around the world. If you're going to look at this situation and you're going to say that there's maybe some primary operational indicators where the infrastructure has to be ready for an expansion for something like this, what would you say those primary indicators are?
I think that a lot has to do with obviously with how economy works in each one of the countries that we're hosting this or are hosting this year's World Cup. And it's interesting because I think that FIFA had, in a certain way, thought Mexico was not in an advantageous position to receive the World Cup, maybe because, economically speaking, we don't seem to have as much strength, as much muscle, maybe, as the US or Canada. But in the end, it has been interesting to see how the three different countries have behaved and have received the World Cup, because I think that although the U.S. certainly has a lot more money to spend, a lot more maybe technological advances regarding the kind of stadiums that you need for an event like this, countries like Mexico have also shown that another important aspect of something like this has to do with how we embrace socially something as a big party as one of these events kind of is. I cannot talk that much about Canada. I'm not that familiar with how they behaved or how it worked, But for me, I think that Mexico, or at least the duality between Mexico and the U.S. has shown that those are two very important aspects that had to be taken into consideration. And in a certain way, by separating the two countries regarding how they were going to receive the World Cup, it showed us that those two elements have to be a part of the celebration,
No, I think that's great. And I really like your emphasis on the social side of things as well. We have seen, traditionally in the United States, soccer, football has not been as prominent of a sport as, our American football and baseball and basketball. But of course, the social response and, of course, people coming from all around the world into the United States, into Mexico and Canada has created an entire new social response and social development that, again, boosts the economies. And I really like your point about, the different economies, the different scales, who has maybe a little more economic muscle. But Mexico has done an excellent job executing in what you said FIFA might not have expected them to be able to do. So in order to do that and be ready for something of that scale, there's got to be probably some strong media influence, some media support and backbone to that. So across these three countries, from the media logistics perspective, is it an overall good idea and a good way to capture the global user experience on an event like this?
And it's interesting because as much as maybe Mexico, between the three different countries that are hosting the World Cup, seems to be the less economically strong in a certain way, we certainly have noticed that it has been the most expensive one. You know, the tickets for the matches in the Azteca Stadium, in the Mexico City Stadium, were reaching prices that you didn't see in any other part of the world, even, you know, not even in past World Cups that were hosted by European countries. So it's interesting to see how, although Mexico was an economically challenger regarding the difference between the US and Canada, we seem weaker in that sense. People are so excited about hosting a World Cup that they were completely able to do the, I don't know if the savings or the debts necessary, you know, to pay for what's necessary. Even I've noticed that many other countries, European countries, have done the travel and have done the expense to come to Mexico, preferring it as maybe than making it more important to be in Mexico than in the US or in Canada. It has been so interesting to go out on the streets and see how many people from abroad are being part of the Mexican side of the World Cup. I cannot talk about the US because I'm not there. I haven't been experiencing it, neither Canada. In this, but for example, one of my family members traveled to Houston, Texas for one of the Portugal matches. He went to see Cristiano Ronaldo, and he told me that it's a completely different experience. He emphasized on how the stadium was obviously like in a better conditions than the Mexican ones, but there's something about the people. And I think it has to do with what you were saying. You know, soccer hasn't been as embraced in the US maybe as in Mexico. I think we can have that discussion maybe regarding the female soccer team, which I think the US female soccer team is a very strong one and has a lot of pull with their followers. But I also have noticed that the US team, the US soccer team, the male one, has improved notably the way that they develop and the way that they participate in these sort of tournaments.
Yeah, and I think the males did a little better this year. The men's team did a little better this year than in years past, and that got them some clout. And I think the female notoriety of the U.S. team, you know, there's been pretty historical wins. They've stayed very dominant over time. But I'd like to kind of go back to a comment you made just a second ago about your friend visiting from Houston and going into the stadium. So if we're going to maybe evaluate some performance, you know, you got Mexico, U.S. and Canada as hosts when we're dealing with this huge, you know, multinational event, there's probably some distinct regulatory transportation issues, technological systems, stuff like that, not just by FIFA itself, but even by just the media and the people that are trying to keep up with it. What can you tell us about some of those distinctions? And again, maybe even if it's just from the media side, what has to take place to observe and report and follow and keep everyone up to date?
I think it's interesting because even days before the World Cup started being hosted by Mexico, there were a lot of skeptics around how we were gonna function. You know, we have a very good public transportation system in Mexico City. I dare to say that it's not expensive at all. It works for, you know, for a big city as a big city as it is. But there were skeptics that thought that maybe it wasn't as big and as organized as necessary for an event of this size. One of the first things that they announced was that they were going to be closing some kilometers surrounding the stadium, which is a measure that has been taken for years in many other tournaments of this caliber. But people were scared about how that was going to work, if Mexican people were going to be respectful about those measures. From my point of view, I can tell you that although the infrastructure of the city maybe is not as modern as other countries, people behaved so respectfully. I think that audiences were so excited about this, and that audiences knew that we had all the world looking at us, that which is kind of touching, you know. It's like, sure, we're gonna behave, we're gonna do it the right way because we want to be hosting an event like this once again. So
there's a national pride that comes to that, you know. People are looking at us, and maybe they say, hey, we don't have high expectations, so let's all rally, let's exceed their expectations, and let's execute a wonderful event. And like you said, street closures, stuff like that, that's nothing new, you know. So that's maybe some people just like to kind of stir the pot, you know, and upset people. Let me ask you one quick question before we kind of have to outro to a commercial break here. So going back to the media side of things, the immediate commercial risks, you know, an entertainment brand that's maybe a little more local, or for some reason fails to align the localized storytelling with that broader multi-border global audience, what's the risks for them, and how massive a failure might that be for a smaller media company?
Can you repeat the question? Yeah. I don't think if I got it.
So on the broad global scale, you know, the smaller, more localized media companies that report their hometown, keep people up to date, how do they keep up on a global scale like this when you have all of the international people reporting as well?
I think that in that sense, there are, Mexican media is prepared for this. You know, Mexican media was well prepared for something like this. The big and the small media in Mexico have always done a coverage because, as you said, there's a national pride regarding our soccer team, although they don't, you know, the way they perform is not always the best. And actually, we have a joke here in Mexico. We don't call it the national selection. It would be like the translation, the national selection. We call it the national deception. every 4 years, that's one of the puns that they go for. There's always this expectation that I was already talking about, you know. So the media has always been articulated in a way that they have all spaces covered. Yesterday, I was talking with one of the biggest sports journalists in Mexico. He's called José Ramón Fernández. He's been covering World Cups since 1978. He's an 80-year-old man. And he was talking to me about his experiences in other World Cups abroad, and how Mexican media has always been one of the most prepared media, you know, in comparison with other parts of the world. I mean, it's interesting.
Can I jump in on that real quick? I want to hear what more about what Ramon says, but I think we're kind of stealing from the next segment as far as some of that information. So I'm going to put a pin right here. We're going to come back about that story from Ramon and the Mexican media preparations right after this commercial break. Welcome back from the break, and we were having a really fun discussion about this international, this global media impact and structures and operational changes. And my friend Gonzalo Lira was telling us about a story from his buddy Ramon. But before we jump right back into that story, I want to make sure you know how to find this show and other shows like his show on the Now Media TV network. The best part is you can easily go to nowmedia.tv, the website. You can also find the app on Roku or iOS. You can unlock all of this nonstop bilingual programming. You can even find Pivotal Change, this show, and other shows like MFlow. You get the cultural, the news, the business, the sports, the media, everything you want. It's right there, just clicks away, and even a podcast version in case you can't watch and you only have the opportunity to listen on the road. So welcome back to the content we're producing today about this globalization, the structuring here. And Gonzalo, I want to hear more about the preparation of the Mexican media and your friend Ramon's story.
Yeah, I was talking about Jose Ramon Fernandez, which is one of the most prominent Mexican sports journalists. He's been doing coverage of the World Cups for 48 years. He's an 80-year-old man. He's very prominent. And one of the things that he was telling me just a day ago that I had the opportunity to talk with him is how audiences are so eager to follow the coverage of the World Cup that they feel in a certain way like obligated to do the biggest coverage possible. Although they don't have maybe the infrastructure, not all the time that maybe other TV networks from other parts of the world maybe do have. He was telling me, for example, a story that they had to be I think it was in the 2006 Germany World Cup, and they had a jet planned to fly from one city to the other, and the weather was not good enough to fly, so they had to pay some chauffeurs, you know, some drivers to take them from one city to the other. And because they had so much compromise and they knew that people were expecting to listen their opinions. And one of the things that it's interesting about him is that he noticed that, and that's that maybe talks about how media has evolved. He told me that when he started doing those coverages, he noticed that people were interested only in watching the matches, you know, watching the games. But all of a sudden, he did a travel to, I think it was Argentina. They are even more passionate than Mexicans about soccer. And he noticed that all the family members gathered, not just to see the match, but after the match, they had a dinner. And in that dinner, they started discussing and exchanging opinions about the match. And he was like, what if we put a camera in those kind of conversations? So he started doing those kind of debates afterwards, but he noticed that he needed not just the experts, you know, to be a part of the conversation. So he started inviting comedians, people related to the arts, and stuff like that. And it became a huge hit in Mexican television. So in a certain way, I think that by not following what everybody else does, Mexican media has built like their own identity on the kind of coverage that we do. It's funny because I've been told that if you go to these big media centers that they have for this, either it's the Olympics or the FIFA World Cup, there's always a Mexican comedian running around in disguise, you know, which is something that for like maybe that. Other parts of the world, it's so absurd, you know, to see someone with a fake mustache, you know, and a wig and a funny shirt, doing jokes or around. It's weird, but for Mexicans, it has become the way that we consume the World Cup, which in a certain way also is interesting because it gives you a bigger scope of what you are living. You know, you don't only talk about the matches and the players. You talk about how people is experiencing it. And also, commercially speaking, it's an opportunity for big enterprises and, you know, and brands to be announced outside of only the soccer experience.
So would you say that opportunity there would be like a nice way for maybe a smaller media to be able to get that bigger branding, to get those bigger deals, you know, because that kind of dinner table concept where let's just bring people in the room, let's just talk about the game and how it went, and then start bringing different personalities and perspectives into it. Now everyone can relate. If I'm in a family of five people and two of us don't really care for soccer and three of us are fanatical about it, the other two people can now relate because somebody else like them is in the room making comments the way they make comments. Does that allow them to close that competitive gap with some of these larger global legacy giants?
That's what I'm emphasizing on José Ramón Fernández, because when he started almost 50 years ago, Canal 13, Channel 13, was a very small, very, very small TV channel. There was a big monopoly by the biggest TV station in Mexico,
Right.
which is called Televisa. It was a monopoly, and he decided that he wanted to compete with them. Everybody used to tell him that he was crazy. There was no
Sure.
way to do it because he didn't have the muscle, he didn't have the infrastructure. But what he had was the sensibility, and that's why I think it's so admirable the way that he has worked and built. Because now TV Azteca, Canal 13, the channel that he used to work for, and with the channel that he used to compete with the big monopoly, is now almost the same size as Televisa, which used to be the big monopoly, big giant in TV. José Ramón Fernández now works for ESPN. He's not working
Yeah.
for Canal 13 anymore. But in a certain way, he planted the seed to show small competitors that as if they had that sensibility, and that I don't know how to say it, but that eye to understand what audiences wanted. You didn't
Right.
need the muscle. You only need to find someone that, which is, I think, one of the major things about TV. You only needed someone that when he saw the television or she saw the television, it was like a mirror that, was watching
Yes.
its own reflection.
I love that. And that's a good point. It's a mirror, so you're reflecting back and you know what your audience wants and you're seeing yourself in the audience. That's a really, really good point there. So with these platforms then, let me ask you about this. Bridging from, this international scale, is there a good way that like some of these higher visibility now that he's bought up, brought up Channel 3, he's working for ESPN or other people like him? There's a lot of global conflict at any given point in time, and our players go into these different countries and they go into these different cultures. Is there a way that the media plays a role in protecting kind of your international talent, their complex geopolitical tensions? Like, do they help soften the blow, defend their country, defend their players when they're on this someone else's soil with maybe some friction?
It's interesting because I think that you cannot separate politics from either it's sports, either it's arts. I mean, I'm an entertainment journalist mainly, and I always have the discussion. When we talk about movies, when we talk about TV shows, we're talking about politics. And I'm going to go into my terrain for a while. It's not a coincidence, for example, that we had almost 3 or 4 years in a row getting Mexicans, winning an Oscar, and then that we had a Korean director winning an Oscar. It responds to who are the communities that, for example, in the U.S. are now third generation Mexicans that pay taxes. You have to portray them on the screens, and you have to embrace them, to maybe let them know that they are seen, that they are heard, but also to let them know that they can spend money on you. And I think that's something that happens also in the World Cup. That's why I think it's so interesting that we're having a three-nation World Cup this year, and I think the next one will be a four-nation country World Cup. It's going to
Yeah.
be a very complex one to understand, because they're going to go not only to South America. I think they're doing something in Europe and something in Africa. I don't know how they're going to articulate that, but regarding this 2026 World Cup, I've noticed that media has been maybe forced to turn around and see the other. When media now is reporting a match between I don't know, Portugal in Mexico, they have to look at how Mexicans live the experience of a World Cup. But if then the same team, Portugal, has to travel to the US, you have to report how the World Cup is lived in the US. And if then you go to Canada, and those are three different experiences, which force, you know, media to, in a certain way, being, how can I say it? Being sensitive to how people live these kind of things, and how those countries want to be portrayed and want to be seen abroad.
That's a good point. So let me ask you. So how they are seen abroad is huge. I mean, obviously they only have so much influence. You know, we're talking FIFA. So on the field, those players are going to play. They're going to get maybe some, you know, posts and pre-interviews and things like that. They only have so much influence, but then it's the media that backs them, reports against them, critiques them positively or negatively, that ultimately conveys that message. Let me do this really quick, Gonzalo. Let's cut to a quick commercial break. We reached our halfway point, and we'll be right back with more Pivotal Change right after this. You made it past the halfway point, and we are still rocking and rolling with my friend Gonzalo Lira, and we are having a great conversation about media and the globalization, the structure, the operations, and a lot of the kind of what happens in between the growing of different media enterprises and competition. So this is just great all around. So people have heard a lot of what you have to say, a lot of your area expertise, but Gonzalo, how do people find you, get a hold of you, follow you, get more of your brain just in their life?
Yeah, thanks for asking, William. You can find me in whatever social media you want. I'm as at G-O-N-Y-C, at Gonyz, which would be like the shortened version of my name. And you can catch me in MFlow, also on the Now Media, on the Now Media roster of amazing content as yours.
Oh, perfect. Well, I'm humbled that you would say that, but I think you've got some really good things going. So we were talking about a little bit of, like, you know, the competition between, upcoming media and smaller versus bigger and how they do things like that. Now, let me ask you this question about, you know, in terms of just purely on-field execution, you know, how do we objectively analyze the performance of, like, Mexico, U.S., Canada on the field during this era of, like, rapid talent growth? How do you capture that and use it to grow your sport, your media, and compete with multiple countries?
It's interesting because I think that what happened on the field is a reflection of a globalization on soccer and on sports in general. You know, maybe two World Cups ago, we didn't have as much football players, soccer players abroad, and mainly in the big leagues, you know, the European leagues. There are many American U.S. team members that play abroad. There's also a huge development on the MLS. You know, it has grown so rapidly, and there are so many programs regarding the development of talent in the U.S. since college, since early stages, which I think that has give the U.S. team such a push that they are now competing as, in some of the 16 best teams in the world, which is something that has grown so rapidly, but also for Mexican and Canadian. I think that Canada is the one that has less players playing outside of the country. But for example, for Mexico, there are two factors that have changed in the last maybe two or three World Cups. First of all is the players that are not Mexican born, you know, that they get the Mexican nationality once they are already professional players. Three World Cups ago, it was even a scandal if we had one in our team. There was this Argentinian-born player called Guille Franco, for example. For this World Cup, we had four naturalized players, and at least three of them were playing. You know, Julián Quiñones, which was the big scorer. He scored, I think, four or five goals in those games. He's Colombian-born. And you know, now all Mexicans want him to have his charro hat and his big mustache because we're so proud of him. I think that's one of the big things that have changed the game, but also having Mexican players abroad, you know, and that's interesting because the World Cup is such a big escaparate. I don't know what's the word. Una vitrina, something that, where you can see those players shine. And that gets the attention of those big teams. For example, I can talk about Gilberto Mora, who is a 17-year-old player in Mexico's team. And apparently, after the four games that he played in this World Cup, all the European teams are trying to buy him. You know, are fighting to get him into his teams. So if you get someone as young into the bigger leagues, the next World Cup, he would be a machine, you know, he will be a beast. Right. And that, in a certain way, is reflected on the way they play on the field. And I think that both the US team and the Mexican team in this World Cup in particular showed that the investment that those big teams have made and their own teams as developers of their talent have made in them actually give something back in the results.
Oh, that's a great point. And, you know, it makes me think about how we have all these different versions of rivalries and competitions. You know, you're talking about obviously all of the teams want to have the best professional players on their team. You know, of course, in the World Cup, you want to have your national recognitions like you were talking about, and you want to get your people all kinds of experience and accolades from the offseason to develop into being a beast and machine on the field. Do you ever see something carry over the same way, like in the media world? Do you get like media rivalries where somebody says, oh, this is our player to report on, and we're going to try to get all the interviews and all the stories, and we're going to make him shine like a star, and almost treat it like, hey, this player is ours and our baby, and don't you guys dare either criticize him or try to get him on it? Do you see that on a global scale where like Mexico might be very protective of their player and the interviews and the access and information when somebody from Europe or Canada might be trying to interview them and get them on the stage as well?
I think it's interesting what you say, and I'm going to go back to what I was telling you at some minutes ago about Televisa being this monopoly for so many years. The owners of Televisa were also the owners of the Azteca Stadium for so many years, and they were also the owners of some of the biggest Mexican teams of the Mexican League. Club America, which is one of the most important soccer teams in Mexico, is owned by the same TV station that has most of the rights for the you know, for the for transmitting the World Cup and the Mexican League. It's interesting because so they do have, in a certain way, during the league, they do take care of their people. You know, they do have a preference for their players. And they have these clashes. And I'm going to give you another example. For this World Cup, the rights were so expensive that only Televisa, that big chain, was able to get most of the games for them. So they started a rivalry between the two big TV stations, the one that José Ramón made grow up in certain moments 30 or 40 years ago, and Televisa, which, although it's not a monopoly right now, they're still one of the biggest TV stations in Mexico and Latin America. And since they were the only ones that had all the rights for the game, they were making fun of TV Azteca, the competition, because they were, you know, you were watching the game and you had the commentators talking on the field. And when they had the, I don't know how you call it, the thing where you put the name of the person that's talking, I don't know what's the
just the captions or the header.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah, and they had a caption that said, "We are the only ones who are actually reporting from the field." So it was so
Wow.
unnecessary, you know. It
Yeah.
was so unnecessary, but in a certain way, it's still these kind of events are still a way to show who's more powerful, you know.
Right.
Either because you have more money, either because you have more infrastructure, either because you're more popular with the audiences. But in this case, Televisa took advantage of that to you know, even kind of mock in their faces of their competitions. With I
Yeah.
think that as audiences, we could not care less, but once they put it on the caption, you're like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was a big deal for them, I'm sure. So let me spin off this question then. So what's maybe like an immediate first step that an organization can take to try to get some narrative authority of some type of live event or you know, something that's going to happen so they don't get overshadowed by either external politics or just a one-stop mega source for news? What's something they can do right away to try to break through?
I think the big secret is no secret at all, and it's preparation. You know, it's preparation. Having journalists that are prepared, having people, and I think that's something interesting. And you do it very well in the US, for example, when you report the NFL games, or when you talk about baseball or the NBA, you always have someone that has been in the field. You know. You have someone that either has been a big star on the field as a player. You either have someone that has been an owner of a team. You gotta have someone that has been part of the game. You know, that gives you credibility, because we can talk about whatever we want, and we can do it with a camera on or without a camera. And we decide if we validate our opinions, William, you know. But if
Yeah.
we have someone that has been part of the game, that has played on that field, that has earned the right to talk about with the expertise of someone that has the authority on field, I think that that's something that gives you the strength enough for audiences to turn around. I noticed that, for example, in
Yeah.
this in this World Cup, there, since many people didn't have the rights to put the game on the screen,
Right.
they had like these big tables of discussion with experts. If you had a player on that table, you don't mind even if you're watching the game or not. You're paying attention because they have something to say.
They have
And if
that
they have,
special expertise,
yeah.
that experience, that insight. And so, you know, we can have commentators all the time. And you know, on a quick parallel, I've seen this a lot in law enforcement because I have a large law enforcement background where a news story breaks and they're reporting the news. And then you have somebody that's been in SWAT and you're like, well, for example, the tactics actually work like this. And then everyone goes, aha. And that's what you're saying gives us that authoritative nature in the moment. I really like that point. Yeah. Let me do
Because you
this.
have.
I'm gonna have to jump in for a quick commercial break. I want to finish our last segment strong because this is really interesting, not just for me, but for the whole audience. So everybody sit tight and we're gonna have our strong finish with more Gonzalo right after this. Welcome back for our final push of the night. And just a quick reminder to go to nowmedia.tv, find us on the website, get every type of episode in English or Spanish that you want. You can get mFlow, Pivotal Change, other leadership business news, all kinds of stuff, legal. But what you want to do is you want to go on there, nowmedia.tv, or go to Roku or iOS, download it. You can look for the podcast version. You can literally find us almost anywhere. So we're going to jump back in here with Gonzalo Lira, who is just an outstanding media critique. He's just got an incredible background that he's been sharing all of his insights with us. And we just got done from the break talking about getting authority through your media. And we were talking about having an expert in the room. And he said about these casts where people have a player or somebody from the world that you're commenting on sitting at the table. So carry on with that conversation. I want to hear your thoughts on that authoritative nature.
Yeah, William, we were talking about having someone that has been on the field, you know, or that has been part of the game in any aspect, but has that expertise and that authority that the experience gives you. And I think it has to do more with knowing that that person has been there, but not because that immediately gives them the authority to talk about that, but because they can break out the experience for the audience. When we're watching something on the screen, either it's a movie, either it's a football match or a soccer match or a baseball match, in a certain way, we're trying to be part of it. You know, as audiences, we scream to the screen, you know, we yell to the screen, we get excited, we interact with what's happening on the screen. And I think that if we have someone that can break out the experience and make us feel that we can understand as if we were part of it. You know, if an expert tells you, as you were saying earlier, you were talking about the security and having a SWAT member telling you how they prepare for maybe jumping from a building, you know, doing all that rappel thing and breaking into a window so they can save someone, you kind of have already, although you only heard about it, you have already the tools to go and have another conversation with someone else as if you knew about it, but for yourself. You know, if you have an expert that tells you why maybe hitting the ball in a certain way gives it an effect, maybe knowing that, for example, in the last match for the Mexican team, we were playing against England. And it was raining so much before the game that the game had to be delayed for an hour. And all the commentators were talking about how that might change the way they were going to play. Because since the field is wet, the ball moves faster. Yeah. So who's more experienced in playing into a wet field? And I'll give you that, I'll send you that question for you, William. If you think about Mexico and you think about England, who has more humid fields?
I would think England's going to have a little bit of a more familiarity and advantage there.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's an advantage for them, you know? And so once you have that information that maybe you wouldn't think about it, maybe you as an spectator are just mad because the game got delayed and your pizza is going to get cold. But it gives you another perspective on how the game is going to function. So you maybe you're going to be more nervous about your team if you're a Mexican, but maybe you're going to be more excited and more confident about your team if you're an English you know, audience member. So I think that that's what makes it important to have those experts. You need an expert that make you feel that you know more about what you're watching, so you have an opinion that it's informed.
And that breeds excitement as well, as, you know, let's just say, you know, the English team is the underdog and Mexico's supposed to beat them, but it's supposed to rain real heavy. And a commentator points out that you would never have thought of this, but the commentator, the person with authority, says, hey, by the way, this changes things, right? And now England isn't so much an underdog and they might stand a fighting chance. You know, you can have somebody bring that personal touch, like you're saying, and put it in there and revamp excitement, get viewership up, get a lot of things going. And that's good.
And if you have, and if you have someone that beside that also tells you, like, well, when I used to play for the Mexican team and we played against England, this happened. So he gives you an input that makes you part of the game, you know, makes you part of that conversation. And in a certain way, kind of validates you and validates your opinion now because it's informed.
I like that. So I want to twist just a little bit because I want to kind of start bringing this to a head for our audience to really kind of maybe take home and use something. So there are all kinds of media producers, people that work with branding and directing, you know, marketing and things like that, that watch this show right now. So what does it truly mean to, like, take some leadership and design a story and maybe avoid one or two common errors that you see from people?
Let me tell you, I'm talking about storytelling. I'm going to go there. We get to see many matches in a World Cup, as we get to see in Olympics and in the NFL. Not all teams are interesting. Not all teams have big stars. Not all teams have well-known players. So you have to tell stories. So I think
Right.
that another thing that's important, if you have an expert in the field, is that they know who is on the field playing. Maybe let me tell you this story. For example, there was this game where the Netherlands, they were eliminated, but when they scored their first goal that made them get closer to maybe winning before losing, the guy that scored the goal was not that well known for Mexicans, but he had a story. A few days before the game, he lost a child, and he dedicated that goal, to his family. We had also the case of the Iran team, the Iranian team. One of the players lost his family, or the there's stories behind the players. They're not just there playing. They got there because of something, and they all have a story. So you have to know those stories also, because if not, I don't know if you're familiar with this episode from The Simpsons that we replayed very constantly here in Mexico, because The Simpsons predicted that the World Cup final for the 2026 was going to be Portugal against Mexico, and then made fun about the commentators. The Portuguese commentator was so excited, and the American commentator was bored because they just were passing the ball between them. If you don't know the stories, that's what you're reporting. You're just reporting 22 people passing the ball. That's not exciting at all.
Yeah, that's not
But if you
exciting.
know what the story of each player that gets to pass the ball is, now you're telling something. Now you're contributing to the entertainment of the audience. Now you're contributing to making brands feel that they are part of something bigger than just a soccer match, and you're giving something for your media, to maybe show off against other medias that don't know those stories and how to tell them.
I think you just made a huge point, and it seemed subtle, but in telling the stories, you're connecting people because that player has had a lot of struggle and sacrifice, and they're not just some millionaire superstar player on the field. They've overcome tragedy. They've had hardship in their life. Maybe it's injuries, loss of loved ones, and all of us have experienced that. So you're no longer just looking at chess pieces on a chessboard, but
Exactly.
real humans with real passion and real stories. And then people get to connect their brand to that as well. And our brand represents this person's struggle, which is you, the audience members' struggle. And these stories unite us. And it's not just like you said, 22 people kicking a ball back and forth. So let me ask you this. Looking forward to the next decade, this is probably be our last question of the night. Entertainment, journalism, global media culture, okay? What specific capability is going to separate the people that have that high impact, the high storytelling from just your basic news accumulators that just spit out the facts in real time?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's no secret. We live in an era where media has been democratized in a way that if you have a cell phone, if you have a computer, if you have a microphone, you can build your own media, in a certain way. So I'm going back to what I was talking about earlier. You have to be prepared. I think that preparation and storytelling techniques are the things that make us, being different from some media output that just puts the facts. I mean, the facts are important, information is important, but you have to develop personality. You have to develop a voice of your own, and that voice of your own has to do with what stories you choose to tell, and how you choose to tell them. You have to, you have you gotta have the muscle and the charisma enough to be different, and to know what's the story that everybody's already telling, and how can I add something new to it? Either it's because I have different information that I can add up to it, or maybe mm-hmm. I have a style of my own to make it, you know, interesting for someone else. You have to know your audience.
So I love that. So you've got to know your audience. So Gonzalo, our audience for sure is going to want to know you more after this. Can you tell us where to find you one more time, please?
Yeah, I'm on all social media as at Gonyz. It's at GONYZ. And you can watch me on Now Media. I'm with Paulina Greenham on M-Flow. We talk about wellness. We talk about entertainment. We talk about everything that people might be interested. So and this is an invitation to watch us on Now Media.
Love it. Check him out. We're going to try to get him back on the show in the future so we can continue these wonderful conversations. But in the meantime, I want to challenge you, the audience, to go out into the world and see the change and be the change. And we'll catch you next time on Pivotal Change.